Today I've got a really, really cool guest, someone who I think I probably read first when I was about 15 or something like that. And wonderfully, he got in touch with us. This is the kind of nice thing about having a blog that's been online for a while, is that you start getting people who you weren't expecting getting in touch with you. And it's very cool. However, I have to thank Jason Heath for putting me in touch with him. Jason has a blog over at doublebassblog.org. And Jason met Barry Green, today's guest, at a conference. And Barry then sort of got in touch with us and we had a little chat and decided to do a podcast together. For those of you who don't know, Barry is a writer, performer and teacher. He was the principal bassist for the Cincinnati Symphony for, I think, 28 years. And he's coached hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of people on performance, not just the practical side of stuff, but the inner game of stuff. And that is the book that he is most well known for, The Inner Game of Music. He's endlessly fascinated and just inspiring, really, with all the stuff that he's done and is currently doing. And just really, I suppose you can define him as someone who's been on a lifelong quest and exploration of musical mastery. So really, he's just the perfect guest to have on. So a massive thanks to Barry Green, not just for coming on today, but really just being one of the main people, along with people like William Wesney, who've inspired Tom and I to create this platform on musical mastery. Thanks, Barry, and thanks, Jason Heath, for introducing us, and I hope you guys enjoy the podcast.
So, Barry, thank you so much for coming on the Lean Musician Podcast, episode number 8. I really appreciate you taking the time. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Great. Good stuff. So it's a big thanks to Jason Heath, actually, who I think put you in touch with me. I got an email from you a couple of months back because I believe you met Jason at a conference. Was that right? And he mentioned
us. Well, I've known him for a long time. We've had conversations over maybe a couple decades ago. And then more recently, I've been doing different kinds of activities. And we had more, and we've met in person several times too, both in Chicago and at our bass events. So we're, you know, a bass family. It's not hard to sustain relationships over a variety of forums.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, great. Good stuff. Well, thanks again to Jason. That's Jason Heath, who's at doublebassblog.org. So we'll do the standard thing, Barry. If people haven't heard of you already, I'd love you to give us kind of an overview of what you do. You're a bass player, but you're also a writer and a workshop leader and many other things. Give us an overview of kind of your current work today and what you're up to.
Well, that's great. You just said it.
Yeah. There you go. Okay.
I do wear a few hats. I mean, my performance career is on the double bass. I was the principal bassist with the Cincinnati Symphony for 28 years and active also as a teacher at the conservatory in Cincinnati and always involved in eclectic and unique double bass programs. And while I was in the symphony, especially from 1980 to the present, I'm no longer currently with the symphony, but after 1980, I first was exposed to the inner game teaching on a leave of absence, actually, at Indiana University, and got involved with the inner game of music. I read my first inner game book at that time and was profoundly impacted by how relevant these concepts were for me as a teacher and as a player. And so from that point on, I continued to play in the symphony for another 15 years, but the symphony was my laboratory for exploring the concepts of concentration, which are the embodiment of the inner game of music, primarily based on Eastern philosophy and the work of Timothy Galway, who wrote The Inner Game of Tennis. And so I began to divide my passions both in music as a bass principal player and as a soloist and as a teacher and explore the concepts of the inner game, which have to do with how we maintain our concentration on what we're doing and turning away from doubts and fears and other things that interfere and create drama and fear and terror in our lives. So from that point to the present, I've been involved in not only issues of exploring the concentration with the mind, but the body and the human spirit. And since 1998, 99, when I relocated in California, I wrote two more books on the human spirit called The Mastery Music and Bringing Music to Life, which had to do with the human spirit, as I say, and the body. And the last work, Bringing Music to Life, which is essentially a methodology for physical skills, very similar to The Inner Game, but for the body. So these three topics make up mind, body, and spirit. And I remain active as a teacher, bass teacher, as a bass soloist, and then performing clinics and residencies, and do a lot of traveling to music institutions, music schools, teacher trainings, conferences, conventions, things like that, where I'm engaged as a speaker or a clinician doing work in the mind-body-spirit field.
Right. So, I mean, obviously it sounds like that the time when you discovered the Inner Game work was a fairly defining moment in your professional career. Would that be fair to say?
You know, yes. It was a wonderful venue for me to network and learn from not just bass players, but all musicians in all areas and people in the arts that included dance and drama and many other fields as well. And so it was an opening. And then having completed the work, The Inner Game of Music was actually published in 1986, but I began the research and working with Galway in 1980. That took 3 to 4 years, and then ultimately with the publication and then beginning to do engagements, then I got to be a part of a larger artistic community, which is my source of my own inspiration, which has led one thing leads to the next, because I would never be talking to doctors or golf professionals or scientists or creative people in music had I not written The Inner Game of Music.
Yeah. I'm really particularly interested in those 3 years that you were working with Timothy Galway on preparing, I suppose, for you writing the book. What was your first contact with Timothy Galway? And then what did those years look like?
Well, when I am exposed to something that's really, really valuable, I'm very aggressive at acquiring it for myself. it's a necessity. So, for example, I'm not currently looking for an instrument, a string bass. I'm very happy with the instrument that I've had for 23 years, but I've recently played and am ready to acquire something because it's better than what I have. And once I have the sights, and if it's doable for myself, nothing's going to stop me from doing something that's going to help me be better at what I do. And so when I saw the potential and the power of the Inner Game for primarily my teaching, because I really wasn't a basket case with nerves. I mean, it's not like I had this terrible problem that I couldn't play because I was so distracted by my own doubts and fears, but I was very much involved in teaching and its relevance in everything, also non-musical things. It was like, it's a consciousness. I mean, it's based on Eastern philosophy. So Zen principles have been around for thousands of years, and some people live their lives by these principles. We are applying them very specifically to the performance or the pedagogy of music. And so in doing that, there is a lot of potential and power for that. So when I saw that, I got very excited. I just called Timothy Galway on the telephone. He lived in Los Angeles, and I'm originally from Los Angeles, even though I was in Cincinnati. And I would go home to see my parents, and I would have a way to meet with him. And so he just told me that many people approach him to do the Inner Game of everything, and that he would be open to meeting me, but not for the purpose of writing a book or just riding on his successful coattails. And he said, if you're interested in music, inner game of music, not the inner game of bass, he would be certainly open to meeting me and exploring that, because it needed a ground roots exploration. You can't just do a translation of the tennis book into music and say, oh, this technique would mean this with the piano or this with the bow or this with your breath. And so it involves a ground roots discovery. And he said, if you're willing to go teach piano lessons and voice lessons and work with choirs and orchestras and in general, I'll guide you. But also without any expectation that we're going to work together. It's just for exploring from an original place where this applies to the arts. And then we'll talk about this exploration, and I'll mentor you as we go through this time of networking with other artists in the arts. And that consisted of I would go out home to California, and he would be doing a tennis training, and I'd watch him teach, and then he'd go out on the golf course, and then he'd talk to business people and telephone operators, and I would learn the pedagogy side of the inner game from Galway, and then I would do my own work over the next literally 3 years. And
so were you teaching during that time? So presumably you were taking these kind of concepts back into the teaching room.
Exactly. I was doing my homework, you know, and that took courage, frankly. I mean, because all I did was teach bass and play the bass prior to that. And who am I to go out there and start looking at teaching a piano lessons or working with a choir? It was not in my training. But the methodology and observing Timothy Galway express these principles to groups and to students was a very direct transfer. And if I stuck to the process of just helping a person help themselves, it was pretty simple. It was remarkably simple and effective. And ultimately, when I could observe his teaching, I could go back and I could teach with his techniques, even tennis players, how to play tennis when I'm not a tennis pro.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Timothy Galway came to University of Cincinnati and we did a masterclass together when this was after we had worked together for several years. And he gave a masterclass that was like an Isaac Stern masterclass or Yehudi Menuhin or whatever. Yeah. You'd think this guy was some master musician, and nobody on stage knew or care that this guy doesn't know the first thing about music.
Yeah, sure.
And the reason was is he stuck to the process, very simple process.
So give us for the sake of listeners who haven't read your book, and a kind of overview of that process and of the inner game.
Sure. It's really quite simple. It's the studying of three skills that come through the experiences of the individual. And so it's essentially learning and discovering through your own attention and your own awareness. And so these three skills are called awareness skills, commitment skills, and trust skills. And we're striving for a combined state of what we call relaxed concentration, which is what everybody has experienced in one way or another in some kind of a skill set, but not necessarily all the time. But it's a state in which we're both calm and at rest and at peace with ourselves, and yet at the same time alert in such a way that we're able to bring to this moment, to this performance, or to this lecture, to whatever it is that we're doing, everything that we've learned. It all comes out in a real natural way without any distractions. We're just in the zone, as you might say. So that's our ultimate goal. And we get there by clearly amplifying our connection to the artistic activity, and in this case, music. So we make the music louder and we drown out the distractions of doubts and fears. And we do that through these three windows of skills. And the awareness skills have to do with just paying attention to what you're doing, noticing what's happening. Don't do anything, just check it out. Listen, look, feel, understand what you're doing. And once you are amplifying the sound, you hear what's wrong and you know exactly what to do.
And when you say amplifying, obviously that's through your concentration. And,
exactly.
And rather than obviously amplification, right. Literal.
Or look what's going on. Sure. You know, you hear something wrong, you look down there, you see your fingers in the wrong place. Yeah. It's pretty exactly. Simple. It's like my mother would tell me to go clean up my room, and I say, my room's fine. So then she says, come here. And she says, your towel's on the floor, your clothes are all over the place, you know, this is here. And I say, okay, I understand, I get it, I'll go ahead and do it. But she had to point it out to me because I didn't see it. When you look for something, you find it. So those are awareness skills. If you hear feel anxiety or hear distraction, you redirect your attention into what you notice right there in the moment with what's going on with yourself. And that oftentimes solves many problems. Then there's commitment skills, which has to do reminding yourself with just what is it that we're supposed to be doing? And that involves, how does the music go? And how are we playing it? You know, are you using the fourth finger or the third finger? And so often when I'm doing coachings, I would ask a person, they would have a problem and keep missing a passage. And I say, well, how are you doing this? And they don't know. Or one time they play it one way and then play it another way. I said, have you made up your mind what's going to happen? And then once they clarify that, then I just have them put on a Nike t-shirt and they just do it. It's as simple as that. Or the same thing to do with the music. Have you thought about how you want this to sound? Or have you thought about what you're doing? And sometimes they don't have a clear idea with how it goes. And so once they are committed with, this is how the music goes, this is how I'm going to do it, these challenges are solved. It's done. And they just go out and do it. It's an execution. And that takes place before you play. Very often, you need to really know in advance what is the character and the connection to your artistic challenge. And then when you're clear on that, you come out. It's like put your game face on. You're in the zone, and you go out there, and you just do it. Awareness skills, the first skill I mentioned, take place during the activity. They put you in the moment. Commitment skills are in advance of the moment, knowing what you're doing. And finally, there's what we call trust skills, which is the most difficult single word to describe the activity, because the word trust can be used in a variety of ways. And with the inner game, we use the word trust as a metaphor as to what best represents the energy that's going on in the music. And so instead of trusting the allegro tempo or the 30-second notes or some Italian meaning, we trust the calmness of a lake, or we trust the excitement, or we trust the beauty in the music, or we trust the song, or we trust the way our favorite performer plays it or our teacher plays it with such confidence and such excitement. And so the true energy, the true inspiration of music comes from someplace and it means something. And when we could access that directly, that's more trustworthy than something that's giving us difficulty. Mm. And it's not what we call blind trust, where you say, okay, I trust it's going to work and I hope it all work out. That's blind. But trusting something specific that inspired the music is very concrete. And that brings out a part of us that we can connect with that becomes the music at the same time.
That's a fantastic way of sort of spinning it or kind of elaborating on the concept. Because this is all of those things I think most people could understand when reading, but obviously implementing something like, you know, if you were just to think of the 3 points, awareness, commitment, and trust, to actually take those into the practice room yourself without the help of a teacher such as yourself or someone else who teaches the inner game stuff might be quite hard. And I'm just interested in those first years when you started taking this stuff to your students and to workshops. Did you find that difficult, getting it across to people, those ideas, the people who hadn't thought about it before?
Well, the more I did it, the more I expressed it, the more I experimented with it, the more experience I got in making something simple, yeah, guiding somebody, it got easier and easier for me. In the beginning, I may explore several things in different directions before I find, whoa, this is making a connection. Let's go down this alley
of awareness. Does that depend on the person, or did you find that there are specific and useful ways to get something like, you know, commitment or awareness across to people?
It comes from me being sensitive and reading that person, you sure. know. And the experience certainly helps, but it is remarkably simple and it's immediately effective. You know, the inner game skills they're mental skills. So in some ways it's like mental health. It is immediate. As soon as you understand something or you see something or you feel something, it comes through your eyes, your experience, and you could retrace that steps. And so for me, I am kind of, pardon the pun, but getting in their head and looking at what they see, sensing what they feel, understanding what they understand. And I can direct them based on my experience to see what I see, because I'm noticing something that they're not. And as soon as they become aware of that, bingo, it's mm-hmm. done. It's instant.
Yeah.
It's 100% effective, and it never has changed. And I've been doing this for 33 years or yeah. 43. I think 33 years. But you have to do it honestly, and you can't use techniques with an agenda to make them successful, because that's literally an outer game. It's not in the music. The 3 skills of awareness, commitment, and trust are all about music, and they don't have words. Okay. And the things that get in our way is a language and a fear and something specific. And so we're trying to do everything we can to silence the voice and become that music, which is a non-verbal experience. It becomes a feeling and an energy, and that's what we're striving for. And it's pretty simple. We get more efficient at using the techniques. The more techniques that I have used, the more, like Timothy Galway calls it, a toolbox that you carry with you, that you can save time at making an intelligent choice rather than doing something that's not as effective. But anything along those lines it moves us away from anxiety and moves us into the music. The only question is how efficient and how quickly we can get to real core of the energy.
So I'm sure that there may be some people who are listening who might think, or there might be a danger of them thinking, that this is the sort of thing that's reserved for people who are in the kind of intermediate to more advanced stages of music making. And I'm sure you'd probably say that that's not true. But for someone who's beginning and starting out, whether they're, you know, for kids or whether they're adult beginners, how does one start thinking and applying this kind of stuff in their practice?
Well, that's a very interesting observation. It's actually the reverse of what you're saying, because what we're doing is we're reducing the challenge to a childlike experience, because children do not worry about all the stuff that adults worry about. And so wouldn't it be wonderful to just discover everything on your own and just play with fun? That's what we're trying to do. So in a sense, inner game is kind of like a Suzuki or a Suzuki-inspired experience for adults, whereas we're, and we have to use the same kind of language that we would use with children, but put it in adult form. So we're drawing on familiar associations, familiar things that we've done, things that we're comfortable with, and a real comfortable state of mind.
Can you give some examples of that?
Well, when I spoke about the trust skills, instead of playing the 16th notes, you know, making a race,
sure,
or play the line, or play the energy, or play the explosion. When it comes to awareness skills, it has to do with listening to the sound, the difference between louder and softer, faster and slower. When it comes to playing rhythm, and if you're rushing, just paying attention to the pulse and notice whether you're ahead or behind. You don't have to be right. You don't have to be wrong. You just have to be aware of where you are. These are just so simple things. What are you doing? Haven't thought about it. Well, let's think about it. Well, is it this or is it that? Giving a clear choice, and they make a decision based on, I like it this way. If they're not sure, play it one way, play it another way. You like this better. Then it becomes their experience, and they don't have to think about it. They just do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So would you say that this is something that then that kids are naturally good at, this approach to practice, or do they need help with things as well in their way of going about improving?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's a childlike way of communicating through an adult language and adult intellect. And the only difference is that we bring more physical skills and more understanding, but the understanding sometimes is the same thing that gets in our way.
Yeah. So, go on, but
I do not want to minimize the importance of knowing what you're doing and making mature and interesting solutions, which adults can do from their lifetime of experience. So it's not about just throwing all your instruction out the window and just going into ya-ya land and playing unconsciously. And you do find that on the other extreme as well. You know, you find a carefree, undisciplined approach, but the commitment is the discipline side. So you got to know what you're doing and you got to know how you're doing it. And so this does not mean you don't have to practice or you don't have to study or you don't have to be conscious of what you're doing and sensitive as well.
So since writing that book, you've obviously written two more and you've worked with that for years. What's the kind of, where has that taken you? You mentioned you work with scientists and obviously people in business and a whole load of different areas. Can you give us an overview of the kind of the places your work has taken you outside of music?
Well, the inner game, it was a fun experience because I once did that session. I did a music session for golfers, golf professionals, and it was an example of nonverbal teaching. And I would teach a golf professional how to play the bass with tape over my mouth. So there's no words, put a bass in their hands and get them to follow me through their own experience by looking, by listening, by moving. And I would get them to be able to play Mary Had a Little Lamb on the bass within 5 minutes, sing along while they're playing and dance at the same time to a rock accompaniment. And that was pretty unheard of. And we did a similar thing at a conference of doctors, of pulmonary doctors at a medical convention, where they're all caught up in their technical ways of communicating the function of the lung. And so I gave them an inner game approach, including that nonverbal bass lesson. And they made their translations. And in the process of doing that, you get to meet these people and they talk in a whole different way. But what's even more meaningful, though, is the people from the non-string world that I would get to meet and work with, like singers and actors and dancers, because I never had really a reason to walk into their studios. And I think I've learned so much from them And, you know, if there is the purest form of this kind of teaching, it comes in the world of theater, of drama, of teaching drama, because we are actors. I mean, the script is our music, as a specific script. And obviously actors are using a language to communicate something very specific, and our language may be less direct, you know, it may be less specific. It's more, it can be specific, like in theater and in music theater and opera and in song. But when you get with instrumental or symphonic or jazz or folk music or stuff, sometimes it's not so specific. But the challenges in the way the people in theater and in the stage communicate to get themselves out of the way of their own agenda and get into the personality of the energy and the role that they're playing are precisely effective and useful for musicians. Mm. And then when it comes to dance, using the body, I mean, the whole purpose for musicians is to communicate energy, communicate that to our audience, and it's coming channeled through us. And so it's a physical experience. And some people think all they need to do is play the right notes, the right rhythms.
Sure.
And
that's the stuff that features strongly in Bringing Music to Life, presumably.
That's true.
Your book.
Absolutely.
Could you give us an overview of that book? Because I haven't read that. And also tell us where we can get it, because I was looking for it as well over the last few weeks, and I forgot where you mentioned I could buy it.
Right, certainly. Well, Bringing Music to Life is literally the inner game for the body. And it comes from this premise that I'm mentioning right now, which is that when we communicate effectively in theater, dance, or music, it is a physical experience. We have been engulfed in that world, and we're living that experience. And so it's physical. And so it's got to come to have a physical experience. It has to be delivered from somewhere. And there, for me, is a direct 100% relationship between what you see and what you feel. And when you see nothing, you don't feel the same things that you will feel when you see something, and when it's closer to you and of the same size, and the closer you are to that, the more effective it is, you know, including touching, but we can't necessarily experience that all the time. So that's the premise. The methodology of Bringing Music to Life is actually quite similar to the inner game, that we're striving for a goal. The goal is to bring the music to life, is to feel the energy. And how do we do it? We explore through three different windows of the body through the master skills. In this case, has to do with our breath and our voice, the rhythm, which has to do with the pulse in which we're communicating, whether we're doing it very, very, very fast, or if we're specifically emphasizing something that's very important. Mm-hmm. I mean, rhythm is the key. This is really the language of our communication, and the movements that we express. We could express rhythm with movements, but we also express different energies like aggressiveness or calmness or smoothness or seductiveness or all of the possible things that are in the human expression. And so those are the three areas that we actually study with the purpose of acquiring a higher level of skill than what we already have. It's different and a little more challenging than the inner game, because the inner game is mental and it's instant. You know, when you become aware of something, you see it, you do make the change immediately. But when we're dealing with voice skills, how we use our voice or how we hear the voices in our head or how we balance the music in our head with the music that we're playing with our hands through an instrument, this is a different discipline and it requires practice. And so for me, developing the inner game of the body, or bringing music to life, I took 4 to 5 years and studied so many movement disciplines, Tai Chi, dance, Latin American, yoga, all the physical different skills I could experience. I took voice lessons. I took drumming lessons from African drummers, from not learning African drumming, but learning about rhythm and how do they live in their world and become such experts of understanding of rhythm. And that dramatically impacted the way I performed and approached music as a bassist. It changed everything. And to this moment, I'm much more sensitive because I've had some more experience in studying these disciplines to what I see from other people, because I'm looking at these things. I'm aware of the rhythm, of the energy, of the way they're using their body and the way their voice is communicating through their art. As far as availability is concerned, there's both a DVD, over 2 hours with groups and individuals, and the actual hardcover book, which isn't electronic at this point, but it's published by GIA Music in Chicago, and it's GIA.com, and it's very easily available on Amazon, but you wouldn't see it in bookstores. They're primarily a music education publisher out of Chicago, but their materials are
sure
pretty easy to get.
I'll put a link in the show notes as well for that. That's fantastic.
Sure.
So there was a question I forgot to ask earlier. Other than the person that we've heard so far about Timothy Galway being a kind of a mentor and a figure for you at some point, who else in your life and your education has been a kind of figure, a mentor, teacher that's influenced you?
Well, there's so many influences. That's a tough one. I mean, as a bass player, even at that same time, my French teacher, who's still around, amazing, he's in his mid to late 80s, Francois Rabat, lives in Paris, but he's really from Lebanon. Mm. He transformed our instrument and has a comprehensive approach to the bass, which is something we have never heard before. But the one thing, I not only use his methods and help bring him to America and share his pedagogy, or even developing his pedagogy, putting into publications with others. But the thing that attracts us to Rabat is that physical feeling, is that when the guy plays, he goes right into your bloodstream. He could make you cry. I mean, it's just something extraordinary. And so he teaches a technique of playing the instrument, but what the impact is that he's a profound communicator. And in my work with him over many, many years, from the very beginning, I remember one of the first things he told me, he says, "Batty," he says, "what I really want to do is make people cry." and I took that to heart, you know, yeah. Because he made me cry when I played, when I heard him play. And you know, nobody had said that to me before, you know, that's their purpose, is to impact somebody emotionally. I follow that, and of course, if you're going to do that, it's got to come from yourself. You can't not make someone else cry if you're not crying yourself, which means you need to cry when you play, if it's some music that is that powerful.
Yeah.
And when we see the vulnerability of artists, we want that, you know, that's what we're looking for. And that's so powerful. We want to have that experience as well. So that was a huge influence for me.
And if someone was interested in finding out more about his pedagogy, where would they go? What would they?
Well, Francois Rabat, not .com, but just Google Francois.
And how do you spell that?
Francois, Rabath, R-A-B-B-A-T-H. His materials are available a lot with Libben Music, L-I-B-B-E-N, music.com. And in Europe, it's published by Leduc. Many of his recordings, he has endless YouTube recordings, but endless other recordings.
Okay. He's, I'll find that link to it.
Phenomenal. Yeah. One of the other most powerful things was the world of creativity. David Darling was my mentor, as Timothy Galway was for Inner Game. David Darling is my mentor for Bringing Music to Life. He teaches free improvisation, and his organization is called Music for People, musicforpeople.org. And what he taught were just what I spoke about, rhythm, voice, and movement as a way of placing the art of improvisation to the individual rather than into their mind or than an instrument. And we learned how to communicate and make music, whether we played any instrument of our choice or instruments we were even unfamiliar with. So I could sit down at a piano, which I don't play necessarily, or a drummer, or I could do singing or dancing, and I learn how to communicate through my body through these skills. And that's what I learned from David, and it's changed my life. Mm-hmm. He's a lifetime friend and colleague as well.
Yeah.
And then the final chapter I did in actually, my second book, which was The Mastery, was on inspiration and improvisation and creativity. And in exploring that discipline, I talked to composers and improvising musicians. And that got me into actually exploring the bringing music to life. But almost every person that I talked to that were composers and improvisers, it just had such a gravitation of energy for myself and inspiration for myself. And I had take home learning experiences that are just one after the other. A couple of my very favorite things was from this famous female American composer, Libby Larson, where she talked about two things that I kind of use almost in every day of my life. One is to let the trash can be your best friend. Do you get that? So with your writer or composer or whatever it is that you're doing, don't be afraid to give up something that's not working. And every time you throw something away, it frees you to see something else. Especially when I'm writing, that's very, very helpful. Whenever I get excited about something, I know it's wrong and I got to throw it away because there's something more meaningful behind it. And this comes up so often to just let go of things. And another thing that she also told me, and this is only from like 2 1-hour conversations. There is what we call a moment of go in our life. Constantly, that we're subjected to infinite impulses and ideas throughout a day, perhaps millions or thousands or hundreds. And the question is that we filter everything. We let it come in and it goes out one ear and out the other or whatever. But the difference between an artist or a composer or a really creative person is that when they get an idea, they follow through or they honor the idea. And there's that moment ago where you take a walk to the park and you see a flower or you see a blade of grass or you smell something. And it could change your life. You could make a piece out of that experience. You could see something in a different light if you pay attention to it. And David Brubeck amplified these principles, and talking with him, he told me how the littlest things, he would compose music by the syllable of a friend's name that he hears, or he would write a piece of music based on the windshield wipers, the rhythm of the windshield wipers on his car because it was raining, or he would get ideas from the most bizarre things, but it was just paying attention to what's going on and using that. And so that's what Libby said, it's that moment of go. Do you let it go or do you go with it? And that was totally cool.
Fantastic. That's great. Thank you for those. Well, we should start wrapping up soon, just because of the time. But it just strikes me you're obviously someone who's is eternally interested in things and studying and absorbing all the time. What is particularly piquing your interest at the moment? Have you got another book in the pipeline? What are you working on?
Well, the last 3 years since 2013, I've been exploring a way to combine this pedagogy of mind, body, spirit with my performance as a classical soloist, actually fusion world musician, more or less. And so I have found a new vehicle and exploring a multimedia one-hour production concert program that's based on the same kind of pedagogy from not just my books, but in some case even further. And so I created these three stories based on the life of an aspiring artist. It happens to be a female bass player, but that person represents all of us in the arts, whether they're dancers, singers, mm-hmm. actors, musicians. Her name's Anna, and the three stories include a narrator, me as a soloist, so I have to become a female, but I manage that somehow, and either a small combo, a large symphony orchestra, or a concert band. All three stories have the vehicles of being a small group or a large group in terms of performing, with a whole hour's worth of background visuals that place the audience into the whole world that I'm in terms of communicating these inspiring stories. So you could see if the activity is in the mountains, you see mountains, but if the activity is in your imagination, you see computerized graphics that are not distracting. Mm-hmm. And so the three stories are called Anna's Way, which is when she's 15 years old and wants to quit music and needs to be inspired by a teacher. And she studied with a great Tai Chi master, because so much of our principles are based on these Eastern philosophies. So it's like a Karate Kid story for music, with a Tai Chi master teaching a young, precocious, impatient female bass player who wants to quit, but finds a different way of connecting. And then my second story is about discovering passion and expression in music. And it comes a lot from the mastery music, from the cello chapter on passion and the teachings of Pablo Casals. And it's exploring the pursuit of energy and love in what you're doing. And essentially Casals' teachings were devoted to, you cannot teach it specifically in music, you must teach it in yourself. And so we have to create love on stage from the love of nature, the love of people, and the love of artistic masterpieces. And when we're in love with life, then we could be in love with our artistic disciplines and express that. And that's what we need to pursue, not the specific faster way to move your fingers. And my third episode, which is called Anna's Promise, it has to do with passing this information on, just like what we're doing right now, to the next generations and sharing it with other people, what our teachers have learned and what their teachers have learned, and bringing a consciousness to the entire planet that it's been here for millions of years and we're here for a short time, and we need to make the most of being here, not only for ourselves and for the people that follow us, but for future generations. And so that's a duty, it's a responsibility. And in the arts, we're sharing inspiration and joy and pleasure and healing and doing good things. Not all professions have the gift to be able to do that. And so this message is about giving back. And this is the third story that I've been sharing. We're actually sharing this story in 34 countries all over the world with different orchestras and different national soloists. It's called Anna's Promise. And it's a very inspiring project. So that the music for me is not only about the communication in the present of music, but I'm actually embracing more at this place in my life a message of a legacy of having to do with, well, you know, we're not going to be here forever. Let's make the most of the moment and let's just keep this thing going and make it as meaningful as possible.
Fantastic. Well, it's a magnificent legacy that you have, Barry. It's, really appreciate you taking the time to share it with us today. I'm going to link to all the things that you said in the show, Lee Musician, and also the video that you sent me about Anna's Promise and Anna's Way.
Oh, great.
So I'll be in touch with you for those extra links and stuff.
Awesome. But
thank you again so much for your time, and we'll speak soon.
Okay, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.